Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
So pretty much across the board, retail demand in November was down from our meat demand monitor.
Kansas State livestock economist, Dr. Glenn Tonser.
We had a little improvement in the food service side of things, but the retail demand declining is, you know, unfortunately kind of an ongoing trend here. We track the protein values. So we give a list of 12 things, ask people what, you know, is most important when you're making your protein purchasing decisions, and price remains quite elevated. If my memory serves me right, 4 of the 5 months that have the highest ranking on price, so people putting the most importance on price, since we launched this project in February of 2020, have occurred here in calendar year 2023. So before I kind of lose people geeky details beyond this, the importance of price is very high here in 2023, and that includes November, our most recent data. So price is becoming more prevalent as a top consideration.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The importance of price is very high here in 2023, and that includes November, our most recent data. So price is becoming more prevalent as a top consideration compared to things like origin and traceability, environmental impact, some other things that for the typical person are not top of mind when they're deciding what to put in the grocery cart.
Talking highlights of the most recent beef demand monitor.
The meat demand monitor is survey-based, and I certainly hope that the beef and pork checkoff that support it find value in it, and our listeners here and others get value out of it. But it is one of several data sources.
Dr. Glenn Tonser is a Kansas State livestock economist looking at meat demand and projections for 2023.
You know, what I just tried to impress us on is weakening domestic meat demand is the punchline from that report. You also find that if you go to K-State's Ag Manager website, you'll find there's USDA data-based demand indices. So yours truly maintains several data sets and monitors demand in various ways. There's a lag in that USDA data. So I just spoke to November with survey, insights. The most recent info we have from the USDA data is through October, which is one of the reasons we keep multiple data sets. But for the 10 months in 2023 that we have the USDA data complete for, only 3 of those had higher beef demand compared to the same months in 22. Only 2 of them had higher pork demand, and only 4 of the 10 had higher chicken demand. So the majority of the months we've had one, if not all 3 of those major meats have a demand decline compared to the year before. That's no longer survey-based. That is USDA lagged database, and it confirms what I said earlier. The last thing I'll add to round this out is this past week I wrote an article with the National Hog Farmer doing a deep dive into the November situation for demand. I took multiple pieces of data that I've already referenced here, but I also took scanner data, so transaction data that's available to me via partnership with the National Pork Board, and basically summarized again that the projections for 2023 were projecting because we didn't have the December data. We basically had 11 of the 12 months in hand. It looks like for all 3 meats, we're going to have domestic retail demand decline in 2023 using scanner data. Specific to beef, which is of most interest to most of our listeners here, the 2023 projections, and again, I'm projecting December, but we know January through November, is retail beef volume would be 3% lower, inflation-adjusted prices would be 1% lower, and that would lead to a net 3% reduction in total sales dollars, income from sales to the beef industry. Anytime you reduce volume and reduce price, any good economist is going to say that's simple evidence that demand has declined. So if your industry's pushing lower volume and has to drop the price to do it, in this case, inflation-adjusted price, we know demand declined. That's not fun to talk about, but it shows up in the numbers again for beef. And the punchline across those 3 different info sources is domestic meat demand has certainly softened here in 2023.
Of course, there's already questions on whether we'll start rebuilding the herd in 2024. Tonser says there's a quick tool to use.
The KSU beef replacement tool. The purpose of this is it helps you calculate the net present value of adding another female to your herd. So think buying a heifer if you want to expand your herd or buying somebody's bred cow, those kind of things. There's a lot of discussion that 2024 might be the year that we pull the trigger on expansion and some rebuild. I personally think there's a decent chance in 24 we're going to have some demand improvement with macroeconomic improvement. So my Dr. Bear stuff might get toned down by the time we're doing this, say the 4th of July. I also think that if Mother Nature allows it, which is code for it rains and we have forage, there's quite a few cattle producers that are interested in rebuilding the herd. So this particular decision tool is designed to give you an emotionless calculation of what the economic value of adding a female to your herd is. Basically, you plug in your cost to run a cow for the year, 10 years of expected calf revenue. Again, we have defaults for that, but you can change them. And it will give you a number that you can compare to what the current going rate is. And if the number that comes out of our calculator is above what you can get it for, then you should buy that female. If the number comes out of our calculator is below what the market asking price is, then it says you should be hesitant to pull the trigger and make that purchase. So that's the purpose of that particular decision tool.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So there's a lot of comparisons to the 80s.
Kurt Covington is a longtime ag banker, is with Ag America Lending.
You know, we had some international turmoil. We had sizable crop inventories back then. Land values were starting to appreciate. And generally speaking, prior to the farm crisis of the 80s, farm income was okay. So there are some similarities to it. What I would say that's a little bit different today is that one of them is the farmer themselves. Many of them have gotten much better at controlling their costs, understanding their costs, and having systems in their business, accounting systems, and help in understanding the cost structure and those costs that tend to and can get out of control if not managed carefully. But the other side of this as well, which has been very interesting to me, despite these high interest rate, land values continue for the most part to remain elevated. And that's a complete other discussion than what we're talking about here, but it's a fascinating view of land values more recently, as the USDA described in August of this year, that land values continue to increase, but clearly at a decreasing rate.
But after years of record net farm income, the bottom may be falling out.
We're coming to the end of the good times in agriculture when it comes to bottom line profitability. You know, it's really interesting. Most of my farmers, particularly across the Midwest, have seen just extraordinary top line revenue. But bottom line profitability is starting to, starting to shrink a bit. And a lot of that is because, to your point, some of the assistance programs are going away. That's number one. But more importantly than that, margins are shrinking because input costs, particularly in 2022 and through, you know, probably a good 6 months through 2023, have really squeezed margins. And most of that is oil-based inputs, you know, fertilizer, chemicals, but also labor. And the one that we tend not to talk about, because most people don't see interest as an input cost, but in fact, interest costs have for some farmers doubled and tripled since prior to 2022. And that takes a real hit on that farmer's bottom line. And I think 2024 is going to be a more difficult year. And I think farmers that have already planned ahead and they're working with their operating lenders today, many of them have to be very judicious on how they spend money going in 2024. So the old saying, right, separate your needs from your wants, decide which costs are most important to the profitability and success of your farming operation versus the things that you'd like to have but maybe need to put off to a later date.
What should an ag lender be?
My view of what an ag lender should be, and that is that we are a person, a group, that a borrower can come to at any time and ask for financial help. And sometimes that financial help is just counseling. It doesn't mean that money goes out the door or money comes in the door. It simply means that sometimes somebody needs someone that they can talk to that can give them advice, who has maybe seen this situation that is in front of that farmer many, 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 many times before, and can say, look, I've seen this before, and I know how this can turn out good, and I also know how it can turn out bad.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
They found that there were about 2.1 million green jobs in the United States. That's 2011. I took the liberty of just updating that number. And when you update that number for the larger labor force, you get about 5 million green jobs in the country.
Dr. William Beach is a former commissioner of the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
If you're going to pursue the area of green jobs in a systematic way as congressional policy, that you have those data in front of you. But they're costly. And that's my third point. Congress is severely challenged, as you all know, you're working on this right now, to bring its fiscal house in order. We've had a 53% increase in publicly held debt. We've had a 42% increase in outlays just in the last 4 years, just unprecedented increases. And when you, what has paid for your increased outlays. What has paid for that? Recent work by Robert Holland, only 7% came from tax revenues, 76% from bonds, and 14% from money creation. So to conclude, you have some challenges in front of you, and I think you need to confront those honestly and directly, and I'm sure you will. And then you need to say, how can we pay for these jobs programs that we're going to fund?
He was testifying recently before the Joint Economic Committee hearing on green energy jobs, Arizona Representative David Schweiker.
What's the definition of a green job? And this may go to my friend with the history in BLS. If we actually, as a committee or even for staff, maybe it would be really smart for us to build sort of a universal definition. And the reason for that is you get those of us in the political class who get up all the time and say, this bill will create this many jobs or this many jobs. Wouldn't it be nice to actually have at least a common benchmark, whether it be on the right and the left, what the hell we're talking about? Second thing is, we have a couple things going on in the House, and I apologize. We're a little distracted, but I'm working on it. And it may be 20, 25 years ago, there were actually some attempts to do some pretty detailed research of the job training programs of the 1990s. And the justice position, I remember it was a long study, it was an academic one, and it talked about programs that had reached out, and I love my community college. I'm from Maricopa. I got an AA from my community college, biggest, I think, maybe in the country. But the data set that came from that said the government-sponsored training that used these educational facilities, what primarily was happening is when the graduates came out, they had to be retrained at the business level for the business mechanisms there. The cost per job of the training was outlandish, and a fraction of that might have been a much healthier incentive, but it has to be carefully designed for the relationship between that employee and employer to have sort of a modeled apprentice program, but allow it to be an individual contract with an individual employer to learn their skill set. Because it turns out, if I get my electric certificate on how to put up electric photovoltaic panels, I may be able to go do other types of electrical. We need to make sure that this job training has the flexibility that our arrogance, which often leads us down a bad path, is green energy, every type of job, is going to probably look different 5 years from now, just like it did 5 years ago. How do we make our education flexible so we're making people so they have a productive life instead of we wall them off from their future?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's always a good side and a bad side with productivity because you have a lot of pigs coming to market. But the good part about it is the productivity continues to increase. The sow productivity is just amazing to me when you look at the story.
Kansas State swine specialist Mike Tokash.
When I was growing up, we had litters of 7 or 8 pigs, and now the very typical farm, the born alive is around 15, 15 and a half pigs born alive is pretty standard in the industry now. And so you have a lot more pigs, and those pigs are a lot more productive than what they used to be. The growth rates are phenomenal. We have growth rates now from weaning to market of a lot of pigs over 1.8 pounds per day and some barns over 2 pounds per day, which is just unbelievable to think of. And probably the other one that when we think about that large litter size, we used to see that accompanied with a decrease in birth weights. And when we selected for increased litter size, for a long time we saw birth weights were going down and down and became a real concern for producers. But the genetic suppliers changed their selection pressure to start increasing birth weights. And it's been amazing because we had about a 10-year decrease in birth weights. And in 4 years, they made up all of that time. And now we have over 4 pigs more in a litter than what we had when they started that selection process. And the pigs are heavier today than they were 10 years ago with a much smaller litter size. And so it's amazing what pigs are able to do when we get them under the right genetic selection.
So there's definitely a positive story about productivity, but What about those gains?
The growth rate is where on the finishing side, it's said that both the growth rate and feed efficiency, and the feed efficiency is really a nice story that it ties into. Is it, when I was a kid, some years ago now, we used to market pigs around 200 pounds, and the amount of feed that it took us to get there is about the same amount of feed as what it takes to finish a pig today. But we're finishing a pig 50% heavier at around 300 pounds today, and so we've got a 50% heavier pig going to market at about the exact same amount, a total amount of feed. So it shows you how much more efficient the pig is today than what it was 40 or 50 years ago.
But it didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen by accident. So what's led to the increases in productivity?
There's a lot of research that's gone into it. I talked about genetics, and that's certainly been an important piece. Nutrition has been a very important connection. We've learned so much on the nutrition. We used to formulate for a crude protein level for a diet for pigs, and then we moved to formulating for the limiting amino acids, and lysine was the first one. And now we're down to the sixth, seventh limiting amino acid in terms of our formulation, so we can very accurately meet the requirements of those pigs. And then, of course, we've also learned how to care for them much better. We've got much better facilities. It's much better environment than what the pigs had years ago. And so keeping them out of the elements and putting them in the right temperature and having the right feeder and water access has allowed them to really show more of their genetic potential.
And at this point in time, we have to keep in mind our carbon footprint.
Some of the National Pork Board information shows that we use about 75% less land today than what we used, so when I was a kid, to raise pigs and for the same pig. And then we also have about 25% water that's used. And you put it all together, the carbon footprint that is becoming more popular for some people to measure is down around 10% reduction in carbon footprint for the swine industry. And that is moving down very fast as we've really, people have shifted some of their focus onto it and trying to figure out how to best utilize byproducts and diets that help you lower that carbon footprint even faster.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This chart, if you were a U.S. cotton grower, should concern you.
Kevin Brinkley is CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
So this goes back to 1990, Brazil's cotton production. And if you look there in about the year 2000, they were producing less than 4 million bales annually. They were not a great concern to us at that time. Fast forward about 10 years, they're at 6 million bales. Go to the current year, over 14.5 million bales of cotton produced in Brazil. They are doing this by breaking out large sections of acres, not just in prairie, but also in rainforest, whatever they can get their hands on. They intend to, you heard commentary about this morning, I totally agree with, they intend to be the world's largest exporter of cotton because they, like the U.S., they use only a small portion of what they grow domestically. And so they are our biggest competitor today. And so if you have been trying to sell some cotton lately, we have not had a very easy time doing that because for about the past 6 months, Brazil and Australia as well have been able to undercut our prices. There's one problem with Brazil. I don't know when they'll fix it, but the choke point for them, or the bottleneck, I should say, is getting the cotton out of the interior where it's grown, out working it onto a ship and to the customer. So it's probably going to take them some time to fix that problem, but they're still going to be in our hip pocket. And they're looking at planting another big crop again this year. The weather conditions down there are probably going to lead to an increase in cotton as the first crop. They can actually grow two crops a year on the same acre in most cases. And this year, the trends certainly look like they're going to plant cotton first. So that'll be, again, another very competitive market for us. 100% of all the increase that you see on this chart is going into the export market. They are a direct competitor with the U.S., and so this should be a concern to us in our industry.
So can we bring it back domestically?
So we can make yarn in the U.S. actually pretty efficiently. The problem is you've got to get it to a market where it could be made into fabric, and even worse than that is the cut-and-sew operations are most always going to be chasing low-cost labor. So we saw this happen in China back during the late 90s and, say, up until about 2010. And they actually sort of priced their labor to a point where it wasn't the most competitive. You saw a lot of that business move into Southeast Asia. Vietnam would be a great example of that. Bangladesh, Pakistan, Turkey are all places where the labor costs attract textile production. You look at the Caribbean Basin countries, Central America, Mexico, again, some real labor advantages there. So I think this is just Kevin's opinion, but for us to reshore a lot of that industry here would take a lot of automation. So think robotics, things like that that don't, I mean, we can't get people to work anywhere in this country, so it would be hard to get them at any rate that's competitive. There's a company actually here in the U.S. called Bella and Canvas that makes T-shirts. You've never heard of them because they rebrand them as other things, but they have actually started down this road. If you got, you can find them on YouTube. They'll lay out 140 layers of fabric on a table the length of a football field, and a robot will go down there and cut the components of a T-shirt out. But you know what they have to do with them? They have to send them down to the Central America to have them sewn into a garment. Then they bring them back here and still sell them for $5.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Lots of people got trained for jobs that didn't exist anymore, and there was lots of demand in new jobs, and those people didn't have the skills to fill them.
Talking green energy jobs, Dr. Douglas Holtz-Eakin, former director of the CBO.
All of the efforts should be on private sector training, supporting these collaborative efforts that we've seen across the country that have been successful for a long, long time in meeting the labor force needs of local businesses and using registered apprenticeships wherever possible because they have the best record of success there as well.
Talking about federal training programs, Courtney Eichhorst is business manager, UA Local Union 412 in New Mexico.
When I went through high school in the 90s, we did have shop classes. We had welding classes. We had automotive. I wouldn't have finished high school if it wouldn't have been for welding classes. I was bored to death sitting through some of those classes. And because I had the ability to go out and weld, go make pig feeders, go make different things, I stuck it out. And then I went to college just to prove everybody wrong that I wasn't going to, I think. But right now, perfect example, Los Alamos National Laboratories. They're going to demand an additional 1,500 craft workers. That's just the men and women that build the facilities by 2026. Right. Espanola Valley is a beautiful part of the state. It's one of the most beautiful areas in America as far as I'm concerned, but they've had issues with dropout rates. They've had issues with drugs. They've had a lot of issues in the past. What this does, when we get to go in and talk to these students before they graduate high school, is we let them know, look, you need a high school diploma. You're going to be making money. You're going to have insurance like nobody else has. You're going to have pension, real retirement plans that nobody else has. All you have to do is keep your act together, keep your nose clean, graduate high school. We'll teach you how to weld. We'll teach you the electrical, and you'll be able to afford a home. You'll be able to do what you need to do with a spouse and children and all the exciting things that, you know, most of us wanted with the American dream. As we get to these high school students and we can do these apprenticeship readiness programs, we get through the OSHA 10, we get through the first aid CPR, we get through the basics that every high schooler should have. I've had apprentices come in at 18, 19, 20 years old. They've never swung a hammer. They've never used a shovel. They weren't lucky like I was to have a dad that forced us to do manual labor and actually made us get outside and clean the stalls and work on the pens and take care of the animals. I was lucky. But a lot of these kids never had that opportunity. So if we get to them young enough and we explain, look, you like working with your hands. You like working on a computer. A lot of our jobs now are very technologically advanced. So we get to them younger, they have a career path, they think, oh my gosh, I have something to stay in school for, I have something to look forward to, maybe I shouldn't go try some drugs, maybe I shouldn't do something stupid, maybe I should stick with this. We get them in these programs, and our instructors came from the same place. Maybe they had colorful past, maybe they had a crazy childhood, and they can explain to these young men and women, look, you have a heck of an opportunity for a long-term career.
Eakin, on the best way for Congress to approach the opportunity.
It's not about the money. First of all, there isn't any money. I'll just stipulate that. And then, you know, we've spent about $200 billion since 2001 on graduate medical education, and there aren't nearly enough doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants. It's not about just money. And the second thing I'd say, the lesson is, don't try to bring something to scale. President Hartzler is doing a great job do not replicate that all across the country, because it's a great job in that location for that demand for labor with those firms. And we repeat this error all the time. Decentralize this as much as possible. Do it at the local level through the private-public partnerships and or private firms. That's going to be the most successful way to do it. And certainly don't try to create green jobs. Create jobs that could be green or blue or yellow. Give people skills that are transferable from sector to sector, because we don't know what this will look like in 5 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Cow-calf operators seem to be continuing to send more animals to feedlots than normal, sooner than normal.
Higher placements happening right now are going to translate into a little bit larger supplies in the first few months of 2024.
But USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says supplies of cattle in 2024 as a whole will still be lower than this year. And as to prices, they've been running a little lower than expected recently.
But still, overall, steer prices are relatively strong and expected to increase in 2024.
For this year, steer prices are expected to average a very high 175-55 100 weight.
We expect that to increase next year with even tighter supplies to $178.25 per 100 weight.
A 1.5% increase as cattle supplies tighten, sending 2024 beef production down by 3.5%. Gary Crawford, Washington.